Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Watson and the Ten Commandments. We're still in the second commandment. The verses are, it's Exodus 20, verses 4 to 6. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. And so last time we did of them that hate me, and then showing mercy unto thousands. So those are the two phrases that we went over last time. And Lord willing, here we are going to continue with the rest of the commandment. We should hear, and this would take us to the end of his writing on the second commandment. And so we'll go ahead and start here. This is section 6, of them that love me. God's mercy is for them that love him. Love is a grace that shines and sparkles in his eye as the precious stone upon Aaron's breastplate. Love is a holy expansion or enlargement of soul by which it is carried with delight after God as the chief good. Aquinas defines love a complacent delight in God as our treasure. Love is the soul of religion. It is a momentous grace. If we had knowledge as the angels or faith of miracles, yet without love, it would profit nothing. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 2. Love is the first and great commandment, Matthew 22:38. It is so because if it be wanting or lacking, there can be no religion in the heart. There can be no faith, for faith works by love, Galatians 5, verse 6. All else is but pageantry or a devout compliment. It meliorates and sweetens all the duties of religion. It makes them savory meat without which God cares not to taste them. It is the first and great commandment in respect of the excellence of this grace. Love is the queen of graces. It outshines all others as the sun the lesser planets. In some respects, it is more excellent than faith, though in one sense faith is more excellent as it unites us to Christ. It puts us upon the embroidered robe of Christ's righteousness, which is brighter than any the angels wear. In another sense, it is more excellent in respect of the continuance of it. It is the most durable grace, the love is, as faith and hope will shortly cease, but love will remain. When all other graces, like Rachel, shall die in travail, love shall revive. The other graces are in the nature of a lease for the term of life only, but love is a freehold that continues forever. Thus, love carries away the garland from all other graces. It is the most long-lived grace. It is a bud of eternity. This grace alone will accompany us in heaven. Question: how must our love to God be characterized? Answer number one: love to God must be pure and genuine. He must be loved chiefly for himself, which the schoolmen call some Latin words. We must love God not only for his benefits, but for those intrinsic excellencies with which he is crowned. We must love God not only for the good which flows from him, but for the good which is in him. True love is not mercenary. He who is deeply in love with God needs not be hired with rewards. He cannot but love God for the beauty of his holiness, though it is not unlawful to look for benefits. Moses had an eye to the recompense of reward, Hebrews 11:26, but we must not love God for his benefits only, for then it is not love of God, but self-love. Number two, love to God must be with all the heart. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, Mark 12, verse 30. We must not love God a little, give him a drop or two of our love, but the main stream must flow to him. The mind must think of God, the will choose him, the affections pant after him. The true mother would not have the child divided, nor will God have the heart divided. We must love him with our whole heart. Though we may love the creature, yet it must be subordinate love. Love to God must be highest, as oil swims above the water. Number three, love to God must be flaming. To love coldly is the same as to not love. The spouse is said to be sick of love, Canticles or Song of Solomon 2, verse 5. The seraphims are so called from their burning love. Love turns saints into seraphims. It makes them burn in holy love to God. Many waters cannot quench this love. Question, how may we know whether we love God or not? Answer, number one, he who loves God desires his presence. Lovers cannot be long asunder or apart. They soon have their fainting fits for want or lack of a sight of the object of their love. A soul deeply in love with God desires the enjoyment of him in his ordinances, in word, prayer, and sacraments. David was ready to faint away and die when he had not a sight of God. My soul fainteth for God, Psalm 84, verse 2. Such as care not for ordinances, but say, when will the Sabbath be over, plainly discover want or lack of love to God. Number two, he who loves God does not love sin. Ye that love the Lord hate evil, Psalm 97, verse 10. The love of God and the love of sin can no more mix together than iron and clay. Every sin loved strikes at the being of God. But he who loves God has an antipathy against sin. He who would part two lovers is a hateful person. God and the believing soul are two lovers. Sin parts between them. Therefore, the soul is implacably set against it. By this try or test your love to God. How could Delilah say she loved Samson when she entertained correspondence with the Philistines who were his mortal enemies? How can he say he loves God who loves sin, which is God's enemy? Number three, he who loves God is not much in love with anything else. His love is very cool to worldly things. His love to God moves swiftly as the sun in the firmament. To the world it moves slowly as the sun on the dial, on the sundial. The love of the world eats out the heart of religion. It chokes good affections as earth puts out the fire. The world was a dead thing to Paul. The world is crucified unto me and I to the world, Galatians 6:14. In Paul, we may see both a picture and pattern of a mortified man. He that loves God sees the world, but chooses God. The world is his pension, but God is his portion. Psalm 119, verse 57. The world engages him, but God delights and satisfies him. He says, as David, God my exceeding joy, the gladness or cream of my joy, Psalm 93, verse 4. Number four, he who loves God cannot live without him. Things we love, we cannot be without. A man can do without music or flowers, but not food. So a soul deeply in love with God looks upon himself as undone without him. Hide not thy face from me, lest I be like them that go down into the pit. Psalm 143, verse 7. He says, as Job, I went mourning with the sun, M-O-U-R, without the sun. I went mourning without the sun, Job 30, verse 28. I have starlight. I want the sun of righteousness, S-U-N, capital S-U-N. I enjoy not the sweet presence of my God. Is God our chief good, and we cannot live without him? Alas, how do they show they have no love to God, who can do well enough without him? Let them have but corn and oil, and you shall never hear them complain of the lack of God. Number five, he who loves God will be at any pains to get him. What pains the merchant takes, what hazard he runs to have a rich return from the Indies. The merchant races to the farthest Indies. Jacob loved Rachel, and he could endure the heat by day and the frost by night that he may enjoy her. A soul that loves God will take any pains for the fruition of him. My soul followeth hard after thee. Psalm 63:8. Love is the pendulum of the soul. Said Augustine, it is as the weight which sets the clock a-going. It is much in prayer, weeping, fasting. It strives as in agony that he may obtain him who his soul loves. Plutarch reports of the Gauls, an ancient people of France, that after they had tasted the sweet wine of Italy, they never rested till they had arrived at that country. He who is in love with God never rests till he has a part in him. I will seek him whom my soul loveth. Canticles 3, verse 2. How can they say they love God who are not industrious in the use of means to obtain him? A slothful man hideth his hand in his bosom. Proverbs 19:24. He is not in agony, but lethargy. If Christ and salvation would drop as a ripe fig into his mouth, he would be content to have them, but he is loath to put himself to too much trouble. Does he love his friend who will not undertake a journey to see him? Number 6, he who loves God prefers him before estate and life. Number 1, before estate, for whom have I suffered the loss of all things? Philippians 3, verse 8. Who that loves a rich jewel will not part with a flower for it? Galeasius, Marquis of Vico, parted with a fair estate to enjoy God in his pure ordinances. When a Jesuit persuaded him to return to his popish religion in Italy, promising him a large sum of money, he said, "Let their money perish with them who esteem all the gold in the world worth one day's communion with Jesus Christ and his Holy Spirit." Number 2, before life. They love God before life. They loved not their lives unto the death. Revelation 12:11. Love to God carries the soul above the love of life and fear of death. Number 7, he who loves God loves his favorites, the saints. 1 John 5, verse 1. The mind reacts to the likeness of an object just as it does to the object itself. To love a man for his grace, and the more we see of God in him, the more we love him, is an infallible sign of love to God. The wicked pretend to love God, but hate and persecute his image, the saints. Does he love his prince who abuses his statue or tears his picture? They seem indeed to show great reverence to saints departed. They have great reverence for St. Paul and St. Stephen and St. Luke. They canonize dead saints, but persecute living saints. And do they love God? Can it be imagined that he loves God who hates his children because they are like him? If Christ were alive again, he would not escape a second persecution. Number 8, if we love God, we cannot but be fearful of dishonoring him, as the more a child loves his father, the more he is afraid to displease him, and we weep and mourn when we have offended him. Peter went out and wept bitterly, Matthew 26:75. Peter might well think that Christ dearly loved him when he took him up to the mount where he was transfigured and showed him the glory of heaven in a vision. That he should deny Christ after he had received such signal tokens of his love broke his heart with grief. He wept bitterly. Are our eyes dripping tears of grief for sin against God? It is a blessed evidence of our love to God, and such shall find mercy. He shows mercy to thousands of them that love him. Use. So here's a use. Let us be lovers of God. We love our food, and shall we not love him that gives it? All the joy we hope for in heaven is in God, and shall not he who shall be our joy then be our love now? It is the saying of Augustine, is it not punishment enough, Lord, not to love thee? And again, I would hate my own soul if I did not find it loving God. Question, what are the incentives to provoke and inflame our love to God? Number one, God's benefits bestowed on us. If a prince bestows continual favors on a subject, and that subject has any ingenuity, he cannot but love his prince. God is constantly heaping benefits upon us, filling our hearts with food and gladness, Acts 14:17. As streams of water out of the rock followed Israel whithersoever they went, so God's blessings follow us every day. We swim in a sea of mercy. That heart is hard that is not prevailed with by all God's blessings to love him. Love attracts love. Kindness works even on a brute. The ox knows his owner. Number two, love to God would make duties of religion facile and pleasant or easy. I confess that to him who has no love to God, religion must needs be a burden. And I wonder not to hear him say, "What a weariness is it to serve the Lord. It is like rowing against the tide." But love oils the wheels. It makes duty a pleasure. Why are the angels so swift and winged in God's service? But because they love him. Jacob thought 7 years but little for the love he bare to Rachel. Love is never weary. He who loves money is not weary of telling it, and he who loves God is not weary of serving him. Number three, it is advantageous. There is nothing lost by love to God. Eye hath not seen, etc., the things which God hath prepared for them that love him, 1 Corinthians 2:9. Such glorious rewards are laid up for them that love God. That is, Augustine says, they not only transcend our reason, but faith itself is not able to comprehend them. A crown is the highest ensign of worldly glory, but God has promised a crown of life to them that love him, and a never-fading crown, James 1:12 and 1 Peter 5:4. Number four, by loving God, we know that he loves us. We love him because he first loved us, 1 John 5:19. If ice melts, it is because the sun has shone upon it. So if the frozen heart melts in love, it is because the Sun of Righteousness, capital S and R, has shone upon it. Question, what means should be used to excite our love to God? Number one, labor to know God aright. The schoolmen say truly, we cannot love that which we do not know. God is the most eligible good. All excellencies which lie scattered in the creature are united in him. Wisdom, beauty, riches, love, all concentrate in him. How fair was that tulip which had the colors of all tulips in it. All perfections and sweetnesses are eminently in God. Did we know God more? And by the eye of faith, see his orient beauty, our hearts would be fired with love to him. Number two, make the scriptures familiar to you. Augustine says that before his conversion, he took no pleasure in scripture, but afterwards it was his chief delight. The book of God discovers God to us in his holiness, wisdom, veracity, and truth. It represents him as rich in mercy and encircled with promises. Augustine calls the scripture a golden epistle or love letter sent from God to us. By reading this love letter, we become more enamored with God, as by reading lascivious books, comedies, romances, etc., lust, or it can be sexual, but it also most often represents corrupt desire, any corrupt desire of the heart. In the Puritan writings, usually use it that way. So again, by reading this love letter of God, the Bible, we become more enamored with God, as by reading lascivious books, comedies, romances, etc., lusts of the heart are excited. Number three, meditate much upon God, and this will promote love to him. While I was musing, the fire burned, Psalm 39:3. Meditation is at bellows to the affections, like blowing up a fire with a bellows. Meditate on God's love in the gift of Christ. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, etc. John 3:16. That God should give Christ to us and not to angels that fell, that the Son of Righteousness should shine in our horizon, that he is revealed to us and not to others. What wonderful love is this? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned? Proverbs 6:28. Who can meditate on God's love? Who can tread on these hot coals and his heart not burn in love? Beg a heart to love God. The affection of love is natural, but not the grace of love. Galatians 5:22, which is the only one that is to God and to his people, and a true actual love. This fire of love is kindled from heaven. Beg that it may burn upon the altar of your heart. Surely the request is pleasing to God, and he will not deny such a prayer as, Lord, give me a heart to love thee. Which is, again, the only true spiritual love that's available is from him and to him, and shows itself in love to his people, and even when called for, our enemies. All right, that was the end of Roman numeral 6, which was of them that love me, and on to Roman numeral 7, and keep my commandments. Love and obedience, like two sisters, must go hand in hand. If you love me, keep my commandments, John 14:15. We show our love by performing the work. The son that loves his father will obey him. Obedience pleases God. To obey is better than sacrifice, 1 Samuel 15:22. In sacrifice, a dead beast only is offered. In obedience, a living soul. In sacrifice, only a part of the fruit is offered. In obedience, fruit and tree and all. Man offers himself up to God. Keep my commandments. It is not said God shows mercy to thousands that know his commandments, but that keep them. Knowing his commandments without keeping them does not entitle any to mercy. The commandment is not only a rule of knowledge, but of duty. God gives us his commandments not only as a landscape to look upon, but as his will and testament, which we are to perform. A good Christian, like the sun in the sky, not only sends forth light, but makes a circuit round the world. He has not only the light of knowledge, but moves in a sphere of obedience. Number one, we should keep the commandments from faith. Our obedience ought to spring from faith. It is called, therefore, the obedience of faith, Romans 16:26. Abel, by faith, offered up a better sacrifice than Cain, Hebrews 11, verse 4. Faith is a vital principle without which all our services are dead works, Hebrews 6, verse 1. It meliorates and sweetens obedience and makes it come off with a better relish. Question, but why must faith be mixed with obedience to the commandments? The answer, because faith eyes Christ in every duty, in whom both the person and offering are accepted. The high priest under the law laid his hand upon the head of the slain beast, which pointed to the Messiah, Exodus 29:10. So faith in every duty lays its hand upon the head of Christ. His blood expiates their guilt, and the sweet odor of his intercession perfumes our works of obedience. He hath made us accepted in the Beloved, Ephesians 1:6. Number two, keeping the commandments must be uniform. We must make conscience of one commandment as well as of another. Then shall I not be ashamed when I have respect unto all thy commandments, Psalm 119, verse 6. Every commandment has the same stamp of divine authority upon it, and if I obey one precept because God commands, by the same reason I must obey all. Some obey the commands of the first table, but are careless of the duties of the second, some of the second and not of the first. Physicians have a rule that when the body sweats in one part and is cold in another, it is a sign of a distemper, I guess, or illness. So when men seem zealous in some duties of religion, but are cold and frozen in others, it is a sign of hypocrisy. We must have respect to all God's commandments. Question, but who can keep all his commandments? Answer, there is a fulfilling God's commands and a keeping of them. Though we cannot fulfill all, yet we may be said to keep them in an evangelical sense. We may build, though not complete. We keep the commandments evangelically, number one, when we make conscience of every command, when, though we come short of every duty, we dare not neglect any. Number two, when our desire is to keep every commandment, oh, that my ways were directed to keep thy statutes, Psalm 119:5. What we want or lack in strength, we make up in will or desire to do that. Number three, when we grieve that we can do no better, weep when we fail, prefer bills of complaint against ourselves, and judge ourselves for our failings, Romans 7:24. Number four, when we endeavor to obey every commandment, I press toward the mark, Philippians 3:14. We strive as in agony, and if it lay in our power, we would fully comport with every commandment. Number five, when falling short and unable to come up to the full latitude of the law, we look to Christ's blood to sprinkle our imperfect obedience, and with the grains of his merits cast into the scales, it make it pass current. This is an evangelical sense, is to keep all the commandments, and though it be not to satisfaction, yet it is to acceptation. Only Christ satisfied that completely, but God, through Christ, accepts our attempts if they are from the heart and in a desire to keep them as unto him and out of love to him. Number three, keeping the commandments must be voluntary. If we be willing and obedient, Isaiah 1 verse 19, God required a free will offering, Deuteronomy 16:10. David will run the way of God's commandments, that is, freely and cheerfully, Psalm 119:32. Lawyers have a rule that adverbs are better than adjectives, that it is not the doing much, but the doing well. A musician is not commended for playing long, but for playing well. Obeying God willingly is accepted. Righteous deeds done unwillingly are worthless. The Lord hates that which is forced, which is paying a tax rather than giving an offering. Cain served God grudgingly. He brought his sacrifice, not his heart. To obey God's commandments unwillingly is like the devils who came out of the men possessed at Christ's command, but with reluctance and against their will, Matthew 8:29. Obedience is the chief thing, and this is not through fear of punishment, but for love of God. Good duties must not be pressed nor beaten out of us as the waters came from the rock when Moses smote it with his rod, but must drop freely from us as myrrh from the tree or honey from the comb. If a willing mind be wanting or lacking, the flower is wanting to perfume our obedience and to make it sweet-smelling savor to God. So it's not a sweet-smelling savor if we're doing it begrudgingly or not willingly of heart, again, out of love to God. That we may keep God's commandments willingly, let these things be well weighed. Number one, our willingness is more esteemed than our service. David counsels Solomon not only to serve God, but with a willing mind, 1 Chronicles 28:9. The will makes sin to be worse and duty to be better. To obey willingly shows we do it with love, and this crowns all our services. Number two, there is that in the lawgiver which may make us willing to obey the commandments, which is God's indulgence to us. Number one, God does not require summon juice. I guess everything is absolutely necessary to salvation in and of from ourselves. He expects not perfect obedience. He requires sincerity only. Do but act from a principle of love and aim at honoring God in your obedience, and it is accepted. Number two, in the gospel, a surety is admitted. The law would not favor us so far, but now God so indulges us that what we cannot do for ourselves, we may do by proxy. Jesus Christ is a surety of a better testament, Hebrews 7, verse 22. We fall short in everything, but God looks upon us in our surety, and Christ, having fulfilled all righteousness, it is as if we had fulfilled the law in our own persons, if we're clothed in his righteousness. Number three, God gives strength to do what he requites. The law called for obedience, but though it required brick, it gave no straw. But in the gospel, God, with his commands, gives power. Make ye a new heart, Ezekiel 18, verse 31. Alas, it is above our strength. We may as well make a new world. A new heart also will I give you, Ezekiel 36, 26. God commands us to cleanse ourselves, wash you, make you clean, Isaiah 1, 16. But who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean, Job 14, 4. Therefore, the precept is turned into a promise, from all your filthiness will I cleanse you, Ezekiel 36, 25. When the child cannot go, the nurse takes it by the hand. I taught Ephraim also to go, taking them by their arms, Hosea 11, verse 3. Number three, there is that in God's commandments which make us willing. They are not burdensome. Number one, a Christian, so far as he is regenerate, consents to God's commands. I consent to the law that is good, Romans 7, 16. What is done with consent is no burden. If a virgin gives her consent, the match goes on cheerfully to, I guess, to marry the fellow. If a subject consents to his prince's laws, but he sees the equity and reasonableness of them, they are not irksome. A regenerate person in his judgment approves and in his will consents to God's commandments, and therefore they are not burdensome. Number two, God's commandments are sweetened with joy and peace. Cicero questions whether that can properly be called a burden, which is carried with delight and pleasure. Is a task performed with joy rightly so called? A task? If a man carries a bag of money that has been given him, it is heavy, but the delight takes off the burden. When God gives inward joy, it makes the commandments delightful. I will make them joyful in my house of prayer, Isaiah 56, verse 7. Joy is like oil to the wheels, which makes a Christian run in the way of God's commandments so that it is not burdensome. Number three, God's commandments are advantageous. They are preventative of evil, a curb bit to check us from sin. What mischiefs should we not run into if we had not afflictions to humble us, and the commandments to restrain us? God's commandments keep us within bounds as the yoke keeps the beast from straggling. We should be thankful to God for precepts. Had he not set his commandments as a hedge or bar in our way, we might have run to hell and never stopped. There is nothing in the commandments but what is for our good. To keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee for thy good, Deuteronomy 10, verse 13. God commands us to read his word, and what hurt is in this? He bespangles the word with promises, as if a father should bid his son read his last will and testament, wherein he makes over a fair estate to him. He bids us pray, and tell us if we ask, it shall be given, Matthew 7, verse 7. Ask power against sin, ask salvation, and it shall be given. If you had a friend who should say, come when you will to me, I will supply you with money, would you think it a trouble to visit that friend often? God commands us to fear him, but fear thy God, Leviticus 25, 43. There is honey in the mouth of this command. His mercy is on them that fear him, Luke 1, verse 50. God commands us to believe, and why so? Believe, and thou shalt be saved, Acts 16, 31. Salvation is the crown set upon the head of faith. Good reason then we have to obey God's commands willingly, since they are for our good and are not so much our duty as our privilege. Number four, God's commandments are ornamental. Salvinus, I guess, said, God's commandments do not burden us, but adorn us. It is an honor to be employed in a king's service, and much more to be employed in his by whom kings reign. To walk in God's commandments proves us to be wise. Behold, I have taught you statutes. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom. Deuteronomy 4, verse 5 and 6. To be wise is a great honor. We may say of every commandment of God, as Proverbs 4, verse 9, it shall give to thy head an ornament of grace. Number 5, the commands of God are infinitely better than the commands of sin, which are intolerable. Let a man be under the command of any lust, again, or corrupt desire of the heart, and how he tires himself. What hazards he runs to, endangering his health and soul, that he may satisfy his lust. They weary themselves to commit iniquity, Jeremiah 9, verse 5. And are not God's commands more equal, facile, pleasant, than the commands of sin? Chrysostom says, true, to act virtue is easier than to act vice. Temperance is less troublesome than drunkenness. Meekness is less troublesome than passion and envy. There is more difficulty in the contrivance and pursuit of wicked design than in obeying the commands of God. Hence, a sinner is said to travail with iniquity. Psalm 7, verse 14. A woman, while she is in travail, is in pain, to show what pain and trouble a wicked man has in bringing forth sin. Many have gone with more pains to hell than others have gone to heaven. This may make us obey the commands willingly. Number 6, willingness in obedience makes us resemble the angels. The cherubims, types representing the angels, are described with wings displayed to show how ready the angels are to serve God. God no sooner speaks the word, but they are ambitious to obey. How are they ravished with joy while praising God? In heaven, we shall be as the angels, and by our willingness to obey God's commands, we should be like them here. We pray that God's will may be done by us on earth as it is in heaven, and is it not done willingly there? It is also done constantly. Blessed is he who doeth righteousness at all times, Psalm 106, verse 3. Our obedience to the command must be as the fire of the altar which never went out, Leviticus 3:13. It must be as the motion of the pulse always beating. The wind blows off the fruit, but the fruits of our obedience must not be blown off by any wind of persecution. I have chosen you that you should go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain. John 15, verse 16. Use. They are reproved who live in a willful breach of God's commandments, in malice, uncleanness, intemperance, and walk antipodes, or I guess, against the commandments. To live in a willful breach of the commandment is the following. Number 1, it's against reason. Are we able to stand out against God? Do we provoke the Lord? Are we stronger than he? 1 Corinthians 10:22. Can we measure arms with God? Can impotence stand against omnipotence? A sinner acts against reason. Number 2, it is against equity. We have our being from God, and is it not just that we should obey him who gives us our being? We have all our substance from him. Is it not fitting that as he gives us our allowance, we should give him our allegiance? If a general gives his soldiers pay, he expects them to march at his command. So for us to live in violation of the divine commands is manifestly unjust. Number 3, it is against nature. Every creature in its kind obeys God's law. Number 1, animate creatures obey him. God spake to the fish, and it set Jonah ashore. Jonah 2, verse 10. Number 2, inanimate creatures, the wind and the sea obey him. Mark 4, verse 41. The very stones, if God give them a commission, will cry out against the sins of men. The stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Habakkuk 2, verse 11. None disobey God but wicked men and devils. And can we find no better companions? Number four, it is against kindness. How many mercies have we to allure us to obey? We have miracles of mercy. The apostle therefore joins these two together, disobedient and unthankful, which dyes or colors sin with a crimson color, 2 Timothy 3, verse 2. As the sin is great, for it is a contempt of God, a hanging out of the flag of defiance against him, and rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, so the punishment will be great. It cuts off from mercy. God's mercy is for them that keep his commandments, but there is no mercy for them that live in a willful breach of them. All God's judgments set themselves in battle array against the disobedient, temporal judgments and eternal, Leviticus 26, 15 and 16. Christ comes in flames of fire to take vengeance on them that obey not God, 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 8. God has iron chains to hold those who break the golden chain of his commands, chains of darkness by which the devils are held ever, Jude, verse 6. God has time enough, as long as eternity, to reckon with all the willful breakers of his commandments. Question, how shall we keep God's commandments? The answer, pray for the Spirit of God. We cannot do it in our strength. The Spirit must work in us both to will and to do, Philippians 2, 13. When the lodestone draws, the iron moves. So when God's Spirit draws, we run in the way of his commandments. Amen. All right, that is the end of the second commandment. And Lord willing, next time we'll plan to go on to the third commandment. But until then, go in God's obedience with a willing, joyful, and loving heart. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.